Well, as we've been going through the book of Revelation, I want us to turn to our scripture reading, Revelation chapter 19, because what we want to do this afternoon is look at chapter 20. And one of the reasons that I did this is I was trying to look at the battle between Satan and God, and covering chapter 12 is a challenging chapter, as well as chapter 20. So I decided probably the best thing to do would be to deal with each of those chapters independent of each other to help us get a better understanding of the book. And so this will be the last lesson before the one that I want to bring, Lord willing, in November, which is going to be one that deals with the comfort that's found in the book as far as heaven in the last few chapters and the thoughts about no tears and that type of thing to kind of finish things off. I did hear, and if you would like, L.A. Stopher is a gospel preacher now for many, many years, and I heard him speak a number of years ago over at Corinth at the Meek Street congregation, and he spent about 41 minutes, and he covered the whole book of Revelation, taking the position that it's talking about the Roman Empire. And I was able to track that down a few weeks back, and I have that where I could share that with you, where you could listen to him go from chapter to chapter and just kind of lay out the overall thing. I haven't done that, have thought about doing that, so there's a good picture in our mind about how the book flows. But really what I've hoped and have intended to do in this study is to take out any of the fear that we might have because of the type of literature that it is, because it is rather flamboyant in imagery and things of that nature. But our scripture reading, as we continue our thoughts here, in chapter 19 is where we have Christ at the start of the chapter. He's on his white horse, and he's leading his army in heaven to victory. And that's how the 19th chapter starts. And we've dealt with that when we've talked about one of the portraits of Jesus as him on the white horse as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And so in verse 17 to 21, which Chad has read, there is the beast and there's the kings of the earth and there's these armies, and they're ready to make war against Christ on his white horse and his armies. And so that's what we find. That's where we've been talking about Satan versus God in the book. And really that's one of the topics or themes, is that the devil is out here trying to, like a roaring lion, he's trying to get us today to denounce our, to deny the Lord, to try to get us to move away, like we talked about this morning and last week. That he'd want nothing more than to pull us back into the world. And so he's willing to do that. He's like a roaring lion, and he really wants to devour us. And so what's going to become of him? How is this battle between good and evil going to shake out? Well, you've got the armies that are coming together. But if you look at verse 20, which Chad read, it says, the beast is captured. And again, in the context of the book, myself taking the understanding that we're talking about Rome and as the beast and that type of thing, which most do, even though they take an early date, there's still the Roman Empire is in the book. But what I want to say is, in this, rather than talk about this is Rome, and Rome, that can be dealt with in some of the other chapters. What I want you to understand is the beast is captured in verse 20. The beast was captured. And with him, the false prophets who work signs in his presence. And some of that is discussed in the book. It's almost like they're fooling people through as a ventriloquism. You know, that's some of the imagery in the book, is they're making things come to life. It's like they're throwing their voice and they're fooling people and deceiving people. And so they're identified here as these false prophets, these people that are deceiving. But they're captured along with these. The beast is in the false prophets who have been deceiving so many people. And as the text says, they now bear the mark of the beast and had even worshipped the beast image. And that is the emperor worship that is found in the book. That's not something that we would say, oh, that would never happen. Yeah, it did. We can read about it where Nebuchadnezzar builds a statue, and that's what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is all about. Yeah, you have to bow down to my image, and if you don't bow down to the image, you're going to be thrown into a fiery furnace. And so that's what that story is. Well, this is Rome, and this is all the ungodliness that has been taking place, and that they have been deceiving the nations. They've been causing the nations. They're the ruling empire. They've conquered, really, the known world. They're vast and they're huge, and they have been deceiving the nations. They're having people bow down to men. The Roman emperor, specifically, was someone that believed that you got to bow down to me because I'm God. And you can imagine how troubling that would be for the Christian. But many people, so as to not lose their life, that's exactly what they would do. And the same type of thing would happen today. People would just go ahead and say, well, it's no big deal. I'll cross my fingers. God will understand. But that's not what we've been seeing in the book. We've been seeing martyrs that have actually died for the cause of Christ. And they're persecuted because they are Christians. And that is really the battle that is taking place. What's going to become of God's people in such tragic persecution that is taking place? Well, Rome is defeated. And what we find here is the beast is captured and these two are cast into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone, there at the end of verse 20. And so basically what you see in this imagery is, okay, Rome isn't going to last. Well, isn't that the fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy? Daniel had said that there's the image and there's the different parts of the image, and the last one is the Roman Empire, and during that time the Christ would be born, the Messiah would come, and Jesus comes during the time that the Romans are ruling the world. But in Daniel, he says, but there's one kingdom that's going to outlast them all, and that is the kingdom of God. And so this empire no longer exists. And what we see in this imagery is, yes, it will not last. It will not last. In verse 17, there, it says that they cried with a loud voice, saying, come and gather together for the supper of the great God. And so it's this picture of this great feast and how the birds are going to be full. I think we've already talked about some of that. But what we find is that the rest, in verse 21, are killed with the sword, which proceeded from the mouth of him who sat on the horse, which is earlier in the chapter. So you picture, you know, Christ on a white horse, and he's got this sword coming out of his mouth. But we've already seen that in the very beginning of the book. We've seen that picture, that image of Christ, who's going to, again, conquer and be victorious. And so we find that not only is the beast and those that these false prophets, but anybody that bore the mark of the beast and had worshipped his image there in verse 20, they're all cast into the fire and brimstone. And the rest, they're killed with the sword that proceeds from his mouth. So basically what I want you to do is, what that does is that sets up what's going to happen in chapter 20, is that thought. So the birds are full because all of the people have been slain, those that have been wreaking havoc, deceiving the nations. Now they have been feasted upon and the birds are full. So now when we come into chapter 20, before we do that, let me talk about some things in particular. One is premillennialism. We're not here to study premillennialism tonight. But basically, this is the teaching that there's going to be Christ came. He was crucified. He went to heaven. The church began, but then he's going to return. There is going to be this rapture. There's going to be 7 years of tribulation. Then he'll return again. And there will be a thousand-year reign, and I think this is supposed to say Satan right here is loose. Whoops. Satan is loosed. I don't know where that went. And then there's this, the wicked and judgment, heaven and hell and the casting out. And there's variations of this, but what I wanted to say about this is what is not mentioned, and this comes from Farrell Jenkins and some of his thoughts, but some things that are not mentioned in chapter 20, which is where they grab a hold of the thousand-year reign and And Christ is going to come. He's going to sit on David's throne. Let me back that up. You know, and there's going to be a rapture. And how would you like to be in a plane where the pilot believes he's going to have a rapture, and all of a sudden your pilot's gone? You know, that's basically what you're being told. The kids in class used to, I think they did this to Colley Caldwell one year when he was teaching. He would come in about the time he was going to cover some of this, and they would leave their shoes at their seats, and they wouldn't be there, but their shoes were left, and everybody would get, you know, like he'd probably never seen that 100 times, but I heard tell that they would do that every now and then. But let me talk about some things very quickly that are not mentioned in chapter 20. Well, the second coming of Christ is not mentioned in chapter 20. A resurrection of the body. I saw the souls of them. It's not talking about a resurrected body. There is no reign on earth that's even discussed in the chapter. The literal throne of David. Nothing is said about David and his throne and setting up on David's throne. There's nothing like that mentioned in chapter 20. Jerusalem or the land of Palestine is not mentioned in the chapter. And Christ on earth is not going to be mentioned in the chapter. And yet you have this whole doctrine that comes from this whole idea of 1,000-year reign and the 7 years of tribulation, where many will be converted. And again, we've studied premillennialism before. But there's confusion when the false teacher takes the images as being literal. You remember, apocalyptic literature is a style or genre of the use that uses signs, symbols, powerful imagery. It is esoteric language. It conceals the message, at least it's a deep impression upon you. We talked about that's how we started this whole series off. And in Revelation 1:1, signified by his angels. So it's this idea of signs. And so this idea that somehow there's a lot of confusion because things are made very literal. But understand that if the 1,000 years is literal, then so is, as we're going to read, so is the chain, so is the key, so is the bottomless pit. And this is imagery to convey a message. And that's what we never want to lose sight when we study the book of Revelation, is what is the message? And so Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 1, basically a 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth and is the thought, and yet sometime in the earth's future there's going to be a 1,000-year reign. That's the thought. And yet what did Jesus say in Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 1? Now this is the main point of the things we are saying. We have such a high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. Present tense. Jesus is reigning as high priest. He's at the side of his Father. He is King of kings and Lord of lords. This isn't a future event. This is something that the scriptures already say is present and happening. And then you have this idea of, well, things didn't get done quite as much as they should have, and things got disrupted, and Israel never got their land. And that's a lot of the battle that goes on in the Middle East, is the Muslims are trying to get a hold of the land and the Jews are saying, no, it belongs to us. And they still see that there's got to be fulfilled prophecy. And yet, what did Jeremiah 24 and verse 28 say? Joshua, let the people depart and each to his own inheritance. All the tribes went to where they had been assigned, and everybody went and got the land that they were supposed to get. In fact, during the reign of Solomon, the kingdom would even grow more, and their borders would stretch. And so we just don't see this idea of, well, the land promise wasn't fulfilled. Yes, it was. So with those thoughts before us, let's read now beginning in verse 1. Let's do some reading, and I'm going to read it in kind of sections and make some comments, and we'll cover this pretty quickly. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, verse 1, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should not deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. And we go, whew, what in the world is that all about? Well, here's what I see. What I see is one of God's angels leaving heaven with a chain and a key And he grabs the old red dragon, which we talked about last week, who's identified here. That's Satan. That's the devil. That's the serpent of old. And he grabs him and he binds him with a chain and he throws him into a bottomless pit. And he shuts the door and he's got the lock and he puts a seal on it. And it wasn't going to be open for 1,000 years. And we go, okay, that's what I see too. Well, what would that mean to you if you are a Christian in the first century being persecuted? See, that's what you need to ask yourself. What would that mean to you if you were a Christian who was being persecuted because you confessed Christ? What would that message mean to you? Satan has been grabbed, and Satan has been thrown into a pit, and Satan's not going anywhere for 1,000 years. All right? So here's what I see. God is controlling Satan. Satan is not controlling God. Never has and never will. God is limiting Satan. He sets limits. That's clearly seen in the book of Job. Satan, you can do what you're saying, but do not kill him. You can go this far, but that you can't go any further. Satan didn't kill Job. God wouldn't allow it. So God is limiting Satan. That's what I see. And he's going to limit him for 1,000 years. And why? Why? Well, the text tells us. He's being controlled and limited because what's he been doing? Well, he's been deceiving the nations. Well, in the book, the way he's been deceiving them is he's got people bowing down to men and worshiping them. Emperors. All of their little puppets that are out here making them look like they're gods. Making them everybody believe that they're something special. And they're not. And so God says, Satan, you cannot do that anymore. For 1,000 years, you're not going to be able to do that. But now, what's the 1,000 years? Well, that's a long time. Is it literal? No. But it's a long period of time. It's not something that's a short period of time, but it's a long period of time. But it's a time determined in the mind of God that God says you're not going to be able to do that for a determined period of time. And that's what we need to understand. Instead of making this a literal 1,000 years that something's going to happen on earth, which I already said, these things are not there in the chapter. We've got to add all of these pieces that aren't going to be found in the chapter. So what I see is that the Christians are being told God's going to stop Satan and he's not going to be able to fool people for a long period of time. God's going to say he can't do that anymore. He cannot do that. Multitudes of people have been deceived into following the beast of chapter 19. Satan's been behind all to deceive people away from obeying God. That's what he's been up to. He's caused multitudes and multitudes of people to follow the Roman emperor and even worship him. And God is no longer going to allow this for a long period of time. Satan will not be allowed to raise up another power like unto the Roman Empire to deceive. And so God said, that's not going to happen anymore. And that's what I see in the imagery. Let's continue reading in verse 4. 4 through 6 says, I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead did not live again until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ and shall reign with him 1,000 years. So here we go again. Well, now we've got this 1,000 years, and what are we going to say about it? Well, here's what I see. I see a plurality of thrones. I see that there are souls and not bodies that are there. and they're there, and judgment is being executed. I see the faithful Christians who have suffered death, who have not worshipped the Roman emperor or his images. They haven't had the mark of the beast, and we think, well, what's the mark of the beast? Well, the mark of the beast would be nothing more to me than you belong to the beast. You've been marked and you've been identified as someone. Because in the book, the beast is represents wickedness and evil and things that are contrary to God. So is there a literal 666 and all this kind of stuff? That's not what he's taught. He's a way of saying God identifies you as belonging to him, or you belong to the mark of the beast. That's where you're at. And that's really about the extent of all of that. There's two sides. There's the good, there's the evil, there's Satan versus God. And so what I see is you've got those that have not received the mark of the beast, and they're reigning during this 1,000 years. What's the 1,000 years? It's a time of rest from Satan, who is sealed in the bottomless pit. There's 1,000 years, a complete period, a long period of time in the mind of God, where God says that's not going to happen. And his people are going to have rest from that type of deception. That's what I see. Well, who comes to mind? Well, back in chapter 6, you had the dead who were under the altar crying out, "How long, O Lord? How long before you avenge our blood?" Well, you've got those who have been waiting, and judgment is metered out. They've been instructed to wait, but now they're a part of the judgment of the wicked. Now, I didn't see a bodily resurrection here, as when Christ returns. But you see a great victory of the faithful called the first resurrection. So this would see what happens is you say, well, there's a first one and there's a second resurrection. And so you go back to that diagram and you've got, well, that's going to be the rapture and the 144,000 and that type of from the book. That's not what we're talking about here. Because as I looked at the word resurrection, souls are rising up, which is a meaning of the word resurrection. And here's the thing. The reason that I say the first resurrection is not this idea of, well, everybody's going to come out of the grave, and or some are going to come out of the grave, and they're going to be resurrected to life, to reign, if you would, with Christ. That's literally going to happen. And the reason I say that is because the book of Revelation cannot contradict other passages. And this one is very plainly spoken by Jesus himself in John chapter 5 and verse 28 and 29. He says, "Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth. Those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation." In the same hour. There isn't a resurrection of the righteous and then after 1,000 years. No, this is in the same hour that this takes place. That those who have done good, the resurrection of life; those that have done evil, the resurrection of condemnation. And so Revelation can't contradict what Jesus plainly said. And so what I understand, and here's Harkrider's quote on this. Robert Harkrider says, "The first resurrection is therefore the emergence of the cause of Christ out of apparent defeat, comparable to Israel's emergence out of the valley of dry bones." That's Ezekiel 37. That's when there was all of these bones in the valley. And it was God's imagery of, he says, "Ezekiel, what do you see?" "Well, I see a bunch of bones out there." And he says, "You see those bones? I'm going to make those bones come back to life, and I'm going to put tissue and muscle and everything back onto them, and they're going to come back to life." It's that type of imagery that is here. These that have been martyred and killed, don't worry. The book's telling you that's okay. You're going to be victorious. And as he goes on to say, "Those who had part in the period of struggle shall be joyously and victoriously rewarded. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life." And the passages that he cites here. The rest who have died will not live until after the 1,000 years, verse 5. And here's the wonderful message in verse 6 that you need to latch on to. Because what he says here is, to be a part of Christ's reign, having not denied Jesus, even dying for him, therefore you are assured that you will not die again. he says that's the second death. Let me read this again. Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection over such that the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Beginning in verse 7. Now when 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophets are. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. After a long period of time, Satan is going to be released. If you go back to verse 3, but after these things, he must be released for a little while. Well, the bottomless pit has been his prison. But he's allowed again for a short period of time to deceive the nations again. You remember? That's what was limited. You can't do that. But for a short period of time, he's allowed to deceive the nations. And so he goes out. And he goes out in all directions in these verses. He goes out everywhere. He goes out, he's going to gather an army for battle. Satan versus God. He rounds up Gog and Magog, and off we go in Gog and Magog. You know, the only thing you can read about Gog and Magog is outside of Ezekiel 38 and 39, where it says that in that passage it says God told Ezekiel to set his face against Gog in the land of Magog. God said, put your face against them. Well, if God says to his prophet, put your face against them, not for them, that's not a good thing. And that's really all you can read about Gog and Magog. And so you get all caught up in who's Gog and who's Magog. And today what happens is they say, well, that's Russia and China. That's Russia and China. Who do you think it was? I was thinking, you know, in World War II, it had to be Germany and Japan. And so who's the dominant force? Who's this force? Who's this that's going to come? He's going to deceive the nations. What are these nations? Well, it's the communism, you see, and off we go. This is not, Gog and Magog is not the point. See, don't get caught up. What's the point? Satan goes out, he goes everywhere, he's going to get himself an army. He goes into Gog and Magog, and what happens? Well, they surround the camp of the saints. Uh-oh, God's people are in trouble. No, they're not. No, they're not, because God sends out fire from heaven and devours them. And that's all there is to it. The battle's done, and I usually clap my hands and scare everybody to half to death. But that's That's it. Satan versus God. Who won? What happened to the devil? Well, he's cast into the lake of fire of brimstone. He's put right where the beast and the false prophets were. And you know what's different this time? He's going to be tormented day and night forever and ever and ever. This isn't for a period of time. He's thrown in a bottomless pit, and then he'll be loosed. He's gone. And then you come into chapter 21 and 22 where we start talking about the new Jerusalem and all the wonderful comforts that lie ahead for those that are faithful unto death. There's no battle because God is protecting His people. And so should we be persecuted for Christ, you too will know God wins. So be faithful to Him. You see, if we get to a point, and I hope none of you have the heart or the attitude where you think, well, Stacy's going to be the one preaching against these things. He'll be the one they'll throw in prison. Good luck, Stacy. I don't know where and how, but all through time, I mean, we've got brethren in different parts of the world that are persecuted. I told you about Rick Lanning going to China, and they followed him. There's one preacher that can't go. Every time he goes, in fact, they don't want him to come anymore, but when he goes, they pretty much follow Him. They know where He's at, what He's doing. Because they don't want Him there. They don't want Him sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so we have to understand that those days can come. We're not promised that they won't. But know this, God's people are going to fare well. Even if we die because of the cause of Christ, it's all going to be okay. That's where our faith is. That life is not, this is just the between the birthday and the death date. How I live my life determines how I will spend my eternity. And here is the reality. The devil, who yet again has deceived the nations and the multitudes, is gone. Is gone. Forever and ever tormented. Now, do you want to go where the devil's at? And spend eternity in the devil's hell? Well, Jesus is the one who talks the most about condemnation and hell. And so the message through verse 10 is the defeat of Satan, and it's not the thousand-year reign. Do you understand that? Sometimes don't let people just take you off on a wild goose chase. Bring him back and say, what's the point? Is it about the 1,000 years, or it's about what happens when Satan has his opportunity to yet deceive the nations again? He's going down. God wins. God wins. So to sum things up, I want to go back to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. And I want to begin reading in verse 18. Daniel 7, beginning in verse 18. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever, forever and ever. Then I wished to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different than all the others, that's Rome, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and trampled the residue with their feet, with its feet, the 10 horns that were on its head and the horns which came up before, which 3 fell, namely the horn which had eyes and a mouth, which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different than all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it and break it in pieces. The 10 horns are the 10 kings, who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first ones, and shall subdue 3 kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and laws. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time's time and a half time. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. This is the end of the account. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly troubled me, and my countenance changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. That is a picture of what we're seeing in the book of Revelation. Rome is defeated. Satan is defeated. And let's go back now and finish the chapter, and the lesson will be yours. Go back to chapter 20, and we'll pick up our reading in verse 11. Then I saw a great white throne, and him who sat on it, whose face the earth and the heavens fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God, and books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged according to the works by the things which were written in the books. The sea gave up the dead who were in it, and death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them. And they were judged, each one according to his works. Then death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. Judgment. anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. Is your name written in the book of life? I know God knows who you are. I know He has a record. The image is very clear that God knows what's going on in your life. And He's got this image of a book. I heard Rick Lanning say when I was there, he would make comment. He says, that's in the mind of God. In the mind of God, God knows. He knows you. Is your name written there in the book of life? If it is not, it may not be written there because you never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so you have an opportunity tonight to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ. Your name will be put in the book of life. Be faithful unto death. If your faithfulness and you turn back, your name can be blotted out. The scriptures talk about having your name blotted out of that book. So if you're a Christian, your name's been blemished or blotted out, then you can come to the Savior again and confess your sin and turn from your sin and pray to God, and God will put your name back in. So God has, in a sense, this picture of a record. So where do you fit in all of this? Where's your name recorded? I love the song, when the roll is called up yonder, I will be there. I want my name to be called. I want to be able to say, I'm here. I'm ready to go. Are you ready to meet the Lord? If you're not, why not do something about it tonight as together we stand and sing?